Side 14. Bella Blair was dead. She was lying on her side, her hands clutched on the stock of a musket, whose bayonet was buried in her body. I heard a moan behind me, and there was the riding master, flopped against the parapet, his shirt soaked in blood, trying to reach for the fallen water jackal. I stumbled over to him and held it up to his lips. He sucked it, groaning, and then let his head fall back.
"Beat 'em, did we?"
says he, painfully. I could only nod. I took a gulp at the jackal myself, and offered him another swig, but he turned his head feebly aside. There was nothing to be done for him. His life was running out of him where he lay.
"Beat 'em," says he again. "Damn good. Thought they was going to ride clean over us there. For a moment."
He coughed blood, and his voice trailed away into a whisper.
"They shaped well, though. Didn't they? Shaped well. My Bengalis."
He closed his eyes.
"I thought they shaped uncommon well."
I looked down the entrenchment. About half the defenders were on their feet at the parapet, I reckoned. In between the sprawled, silent figures, the groaning, writhing wounded waiting for the stretchers, the tangle of gear and fallen weapons, the bloody rags, and now the pandy guns again, pounding anew at the near-dead wreck of the Cawnpore garrison, with its tattered flag still flapping from the mast. "Well," thinks I, "they can walk in now any time they like. There's nothing left to stop them." But they didn't. That last great assault of June 23rd, which had come within an ace of breaking us, had sickened the pandies. The Maidan was strewn with their dead, and although they pounded us with gunfire for another two terrible days, they didn't have the stomach for another frontal attack. If only they'd known it, half the men left on our parapet were too done up with fatigue and starvation to lift a musket. The barrack was choked with more than 300 wounded and dying, the well was down to stinking ooze, and our remaining flour was so much dust. We couldn't have lasted 2 minutes against a determined assault. Yet why should they bother, when hunger and heat and the steady rate of casualties from bombardment were sure to finish us soon anyway? Three folk went mad, as I remember, in those 48 hours. I only wonder now that we all didn't. In the furnace of the barrack, the women and children were too reduced by famine even to cry. Even the younger officers seemed to be overcome by the lethargy of approaching certain death. For that, Wheeler now admitted, was all that remained. "I've sent a last message out to Lawrence," he told us senior men on the second night. "I've told him that we have nothing left but British spirit, and that cannot last for ever. We are like rats in a cage. Our best hope is that the rebels will come in again and give us a quick end. Better that than watch our women and little ones die by inches." I can still see the gaunt faces in the flickering candlelight round his table. Someone gave a little sob, and another swore softly. And after a moment, Vibart asked if there was no hope that Lawrence might yet come to our relief. Wheeler shook his head. "He would come if he could, but even if he marched now, he could not reach us in under 2 days. By then, well, you know me, gentlemen, I haven't croaked in 50 years soldiering, and I'm not croaking now, when I say that, short of a miracle, it is all up. We are in God's hands, so let each one of us make his preparations accordingly." I was with him there, only my preparations weren't going to be spiritual. I still had my Pathan rig out stowed away, and I could see that the time was fast approaching when, game ankle or no, Flashy was going to have to take his chance over the wall. It was that or die in this stinking hole. So I left them praying and went out to my place on the parapet to think it out. I was in a blue funk at the thought of trying to decamp, but the longer I waited, the harder it might become. I was still wrestling with my fears when someone hove up out of the gloom beside me, and who should it be but East?
"Flashman," says he, "may I have a word with you?"
"If you must," says I. "I'll be obliged if you'll make it a brief one."
Of course," says he. "I understand. As Sir Hugh said, it is time for each of us to make his own soul. I won't intrude on your meditations a moment longer than I must, I promise. The trouble is, my own conscience. I need your help, old fellow."
"Eh?" I stared at him, trying to make out his face in the dark.
"What the deuce? Please, bear with me. I know you're bitter because you think I abandoned you in Russia, left you to die while I escaped. Oh, I know it was my duty and all that to get to Raglan, but the truth is..." He broke off and had a gulp to himself. "The truth is, I was glad to leave you. There, it's out at last. Oh, if you knew how it had been tormenting me these 2 years past. That weight on my soul, that I abandoned you in a spirit of hatred and sinful vengeance. No, let me finish. I hated you then, because of the way you had treated Vala. When you flung her from that sledge into the snow, I could have killed you for it."
He was in a rare taking, no error. A rugby conscience pouring out is a hell of a performance. He wasn't telling me a thing I hadn't guessed at the time. I know these pious bastards better than they know themselves, you see.
"I loved her, you see," he went on, talking like an old man with a hernia. "She meant everything to me. And you had cast her away so brutally. Please, please, hear me out. I'm confessing, don't you see, and asking for your forgiveness. It's late in the day, I know, but, well, it looks as though we haven't much longer, don't it? So I wanted to tell you, and shake your hand, old schoolfellow, and hear from you that my sin is forgiven me. If you can find it in your heart, that is."
He choked resoundingly.
I trust you can."
I have heard some amazing declarations in my time, but this babbling was extraordinary. It comes of Christian upbringing, of course, and taking cold baths, all of which implants in the impressionable mind the notion that repentance can somehow square the account. At any other time it would have given me some malicious amusement to listen to him. Even in my distracted condition, it was interesting enough for me to ask him, "Do you mean that if I hadn't given you cause to detest me, you'd have stayed with me and let Raglan's message go hang?"
"What's that?" says he. I don't know what you mean. I please, Flashman, you must see my agony of spirit. I'm trying to make you understand. Please, tell me, even now, what I can do."
"Well," says I thoughtfully, "you could go and fart in a bottle and paint it."
"What?" says he, bewildered. "What did you say?"
"I'm trying to indicate that you can take yourself off," says I. "You're a selfish little swine, East. You admit you've behaved like a scoundrel to me, and if that wasn't enough, you have the cheek to waste my time when I need it for prayer. So go to hell, will you?"
"My God, Flashman, you can't mean it! You can't be so hard. It only needs a word. I know I've wronged you terribly. Maybe in more ways than I know. Sometimes I've wondered if perhaps you too loved Vala. If you did and placed duty first." He gulped again and peered at me. "Did you love her, Flashman?"
"About 4 or 5 times a week," says I. "But you needn't be jealous. She wasn't nearly as good a ride as our Aunt Sarah. You should have tried a steam bath with that one."
He gave a shocked gasp, and I absolutely heard his teeth chatter. Then, "God, Flashman! Oh, you are unspeakable! You are vile! God help you!"
"Unspeakable and vile I may be," says I, "but at least I'm no hypocrite like you. The last thing you want is for God to help me. You don't want my forgiveness, either. You just want to be able to forgive yourself. Well, you run along and do it, Scud, and thank me for making it easy for you. After what you've heard tonight, your conscience needn't trouble you any longer about having left old Fleshy to his fate. What? He stumbled off at that, and I was able to resume my own debate about whether it was best to slide out or stay. In the end, my nerve failed me, and I curled up in the lee of the parapet for the night. Thank God I did, for on the next morning, Wheeler got his miracle. She was the most unlikely messenger of grace you ever saw. A raddled old chichi biddy, with clanking earrings and a parasol, drawn in a rickshaw gharry by two pandies, with another couple marching as guard, and a havildar out in front brandishing a white flag. Wheeler ordered a stand too when this strange little procession was seen approaching the east corner of the entrenchment, and went off himself with Moore to meet it. And a few minutes later word was passed for me and Vibart, who was up at my end of the parapet, to present ourselves. Wheeler and the other senior men were grouped inside the parapet, while the old wife, fanning herself with a leaf and sipping at a chutty, was sitting just outside with her escort squatting round her. Wheeler was holding a paper, and glancing in bewilderment from it to the old woman. As we came up, someone was saying, "I wouldn't trust it a blasted inch. Why should they want a treat at this time of day? Tell me that." And Wheeler shook his head and passed the paper to Vibart. "Read that," says he. "If what it says is true, the Nana wishes to make terms." It didn't sink in at first. I studied the paper over Vibart's shoulder, while he read it out half aloud. It was a brief, simple note, written in a good hand, in English, and addressed to Wheeler. As near as I recall, it said, "To subjects of Her Most Gracious Majesty, Queen Victoria, all who are not connected with the acts of Lord Dalhousie and are willing to lay down their arms, shall receive a safe passage to Allahabad." It was signed on behalf of Nana Sahib, with a name I couldn't make out until Vibart muttered it out, Azimullah Khan. He looked at Wheeler, then at the old woman, and Wheeler flapped a hand and says, "This is Mrs. Jacobs of Cawnpore City. She has this note from Azimullah himself in the presence of the Nana." "How do you do, gentlemen?" says Mrs. Jacobs, bowing with a great creak of stays from her seat in the gharry. "Such jolly weather we are having, yes?" "I don't like it," says Wheeler quietly, turning his back so that she shouldn't hear. The others grouped round us. "As Whiting says, why should he offer terms when he must know we're at his mercy? All he needs do is wait." "Perhaps, sir," says Vibart, "he don't know how reduced we are." He let out a deep breath. "And we have our women and children to think of." At this the others broke in a fierce babble of low voices. "It's a plot. No, it ain't. We've stood the bastards off this long. It's false. I can smell niggard treachery a mile away. Why should it be treachery? My God, what have we to lose? We're done for as it is." While I tried to keep my face straight, and the delicious hope began to break over me, we were saved. For it seemed to me, in that moment, that whatever anyone said, whatever Wheeler felt, he was going to have to accept any terms the pandies offered. He couldn't refuse and doom the women and children in that stinking barrack to certain death, however fearful of treachery he might be. We were being offered at least a chance of life against the certainty of death. He had to take it. So I said nothing, while they wrangled in whispers there by the parapet, with every drawn face along the entrenchment on either side turned anxiously in our direction, and that painted old harridan sitting under the canopy of her gharry, nodding and bowing whenever anyone glanced at her. And sure enough, Wheeler finally says, "What's your opinion, Colonel Flashman?" The temptation to sing out, "Take it, you bloody old fool! Offer to crawl on your belly the whole way to Allahabad!" was strong, but I mastered it and looked pretty cool. "Well, sir," says I, "it's an offer. No more. There's nothing to be decided until we've tested it." That shut them up. "True enough," says Wheeler. "But someone must talk to Nana Sahib," says I. "It may be that all isn't well with him, or that he thinks this siege ain't worth a candle. Maybe his precious pandies have had enough." "That's it, by God," broke in Delafosse, but I went on very steady. "But we can't accept, or turn him down flat, until we've heard more than is written here." And I tapped the paper in Vibart's hand. "He hasn't approached us out of charity, we may be sure. Well, it may be treachery, or it may be weakness. Let's look him in the eye." It must have sounded well. Bluff, flashy, talking calm sense while others went pink in the face. They weren't to know I'd made up my trembling mind in the moment I'd read the note. The trick now was to make sure that Wheeler made up his and in the right direction. For he was obviously full of suspicion about the Nana, and half inclined to listen to the hotheads who were urging him to throw the offer back in the mutineer's teeth. You never heard such appalling nonsense in your life. Here we were, doomed for certain, being offered an 11th-hour reprieve, and more than half the idiots in that impromptu council were for rejecting it out of hand. It made my innards heave to listen. Thinks I, this is going to need delicate handling. However, Wheeler saw the sense of what I'd said, and decided that Moore and I should go to see the Nana, and hear precisely what he had to say. Thank God he chose me. I don't care as a rule to put my head into the lion's den, even under a flag of truce, but this was one negotiation I wanted to have a large hand in. I didn't want any hitches about the surrender, for surrender, if I had anything to do with it, was what it was going to be. All that mattered besides that was that I should keep my credit intact. So at noon, Moore and I were escorted through the Pandy lines, with Mrs. Jacobs in her gharry, jabbering about what a shame it was, or, yes, that the present unsettled state of affairs had prevented her getting up to the hills during the hot weather. Who she was, by the way, I never discovered. She looked like a typical half-caste bawd who'd been employed as a go-between because she was obviously neutral and inoffensive, but I may be misjudging the lady. The notorious Nana Sahib was waiting for us in front of a great day tent in a grove of trees, with a pack of servitors and minions attending him, and a score of Maharatta guardsmen in breastplates and helmets ranged either side of the great Afghan carpet before his chair. That carpet gave me an uneasy twinge. It reminded me of the one on which I'd seen MacNaughton seized and chopped up outside Kabul, at just such a meeting as this. However, Moore and I put out our chests and looked down our noses, as true Britons ought to do in the presence of rebellious niggers who happen to have the drop on them. Nana himself was a burly, fat-faced rascal, with curly mustachios and a shifty look. What they call a tong admi, literally a tight man. Dressed in more silks and jewels than a French whore, sliding his eyes across Moore and me, and whispering behind a plump hand to the woman beside him. She was worth a lewd thought or two, by the way. One of your tall, heavy-hipped beauties with a drooping lower lip. Sultana Adala, they called her, and I'm sorry I never got closer to her than 20 feet. We exchanged a glance or two during that interview and let our mutual imaginations work. 10 minutes alone together would have done the rest. On Nana's other side sat a nondescript and nasty-looking rascal who I gather was his brother in crime, Tantia Tope. However, the man who took things in hand was Azimullah Khan, a tall, handsome, light-skinned exquisite in a cloth of gold coat and with a jewelled aigrette in his turban, who stepped smilingly across the carpet with his hand out. Moore promptly put his hands behind his back. I contented myself by hooking my thumbs into my belt, and Azimullah smiled even wider and withdrew his hand with a graceful flutter. Rudy Starnberg couldn't have done it better. I gave him our names, and he opened his eyes wide. "Colonel Flushman, but this is an honour indeed. It has always been my regret that I missed you in the Crimea," says he, flashing his teeth. "And how is my dear old friend, Mr. William Howard Russell?" It was my turn to stare at that. I didn't know then that this Azimullah was a travelled man who spoke French and English as well as I did, had done diplomatic work in London, and gone through our sillier society women like a mad stallion at the same time. A charming, clever politician whose urbanity masked a nature as appealing as a hooded cobra's. For the occasion, he was acting as interpreter for the Nana, who spoke no English. I told him, fairly cool, that we were there to receive his master's proposals, at which he sighed and spread his hands. "Well, gentlemen, it is a most distressing business, and no one is more deeply troubled by it than His Highness, which is why he has sent his note to General Wheeler, in the hope that we can put an end to all this bloodshed and suffering." Moore interrupted at this to say that in that case it was a pity he hadn't sent his message earlier, or stayed loyal in the first place. Azimura just smiled.
But we are not talking politics, are we, Captain Moore? We are looking at military reality, which is that your gallant resistance is at an end, one way or another. His Highness deplores the thought of useless slaughter. He is willing, if you will quit Cawnpore, to allow your garrison to depart with the honors of war. You shall have all necessary food and comforts for your women and children, for whom His Highness is particularly concerned, and safe passage to Allahabad. It seems to me not an ungenerous offer.
The Nana, who obviously knew the purport of what was being said, leaned forward at this, smiled greasily, and gabbled in Maharatta. Azimura nodded and went on.
He says that baggage animals are already being collected to carry your wounded to the river, where boats will be waiting to take you all to Allahabad.
I asked the question Wheeler wanted asked. What guarantees of safe conduct does he offer?
Azimura lifted his brows. But are any necessary?
If we intended you harm, we have only to attack.
Or wait.
We know your situation, you see. Believe me, gentlemen, His Highness is moved simply by humanity, the spirit of mercy.
Whether it was deliberately timed or not, I don't know, but his words were interrupted by the most hideous scream of agony, a drawn-out, bubbling wail from behind the grove of trees. It rang out again, and then died into an awful whimper of pain, and I felt the hairs rise on my neck. Moore almost jumped out of his boots.
"What in God's name was that?" says he.
"Maharatta diplomacy, I imagine," says I, with a straight face and my innards dissolving. "Someone being flayed alive, probably, for our benefit, so that we could hear and take note."
"But if His Highness' word is not sufficient," Azimura went on blandly, "he would raise no objection to your carrying away your personal arms and, shall we say, 20 rounds a man. With that you will hardly be at a greater disadvantage in the open than behind that pathetic breastwork. But I repeat, gentlemen, His Highness has nothing to gain by treachery, quite the reverse. It is repugnant to him, and would be politically damaging."
I didn't trust the bastard an inch, but I was privately inclined to agree with him. Wiping out a British garrison entire was one thing, but he could do that anyway without luring us into the open. On the other hand, getting a British garrison to haul down its flag would be a real feather in his cap. But Azimura was a mile too shrewd to say so, for nothing would have been better calculated to stiffen Wheeler's resistance. Nana started to chatter again in Maharatta, while I tried to efface the memory of that awful scream by exchanging a long look or two with Sultana Adala. It never does any harm. Azimura heard him out, and then addressed us again.
"His Highness asks you to reassure General Wheeler, and to add that while you are considering his most generous proposal, he is instructing our troops to observe an armistice. I myself will come tomorrow for General Wheeler's answer." And that was that. Moore and I trudged back through the Pandy lines, and if anything was needed to convince me that surrender was imperative, it was the sight of those glowering black faces at the gun emplacements and round the bivouacs. They might look less smart and orderly than they'd done as loyal company troops, but by God there were plenty of them, and no signs of weakening or desertion.
It was touch and go, though, when we got back to the entrenchment and reported to Wheeler what Nana's proposals were. He called a council of all the officers, and we sat or stood, crowded into the stifling corner of the barrack which was his office, with the moaning of the wounded beyond the partition and the wailing of the children, while we heard rehearsed again all the arguments that had been whispered to and fro that morning. It frightened me, I may tell you, for Wheeler was still smelling treachery, and our younger sparks were in full cry against the notion of surrender. "We've held out this long," cries Delafosse, "and now they're weakening. Tell him to go to blazes, I say, and 10-1 he'll raise the siege." There were growls of approval at this, until Vibart says, "And if he don't raise it, what then? We'll not have a child or woman alive in this hellish place 3 days hence. Are you prepared to accept that?" "'Are you prepared to accept a rebel's word?' retorts Delathos. "'While we're in a defensive position here, "'at least we can make some show against him, "'and he may raise the siege, or Lawrence may march. "'But once we accept his terms and step into the open, "'we're at his mercy.' "'And we'd have hauled down our flag to a pack of rebels,' says Thompson bitterly. "'How do we go home to England and tell them that?' At this, some cried bravo, and urged Wheeler to answer Nana with defiance. But old Ewart, who was so sick that he had to attend the council lying on a stretcher, wondered what England would say if we condemned hundreds of women and children to die in the useless defence of a couple of ruined mud buildings. The older men nodded agreement, but the youngster shouted him down, and Delafosse repeated the argument, red in the face, that Nana must be weakening, or he'd never have made the offer. Wheeler, who'd been sitting tugging his moustache while they bickered, looks at Moore and me.
"'You saw his camp, gentlemen. What opinion did you form? Is he negotiating from weakness because his troops have lost heart?'
I'd said nothing throughout. I was biding my time and let Moore answer. He said we'd seen no signs of flagging morale, which was true enough. Wheeler looked glum and shook his head.
"'I cannot think that Nana is to be trusted,' says he. "'And yet it is a cruel choice. "'All my nature, every instinct, tells me to fight this command to the last, "'to die in my duty as a soldier should do, "'and let my country avenge me. "'But to do that at the cost of our loved ones' lives, "'already so many.'
"'He broke off.' And there was an uneasy silence. Everyone knew that Wheeler's own son had died the day before. Finally, he rubbed his face and looked round.
If it were ourselves alone, there could be but one answer. As it is, I confess I should be tempted, for our women and children's sake, to accept this murderer's terms, were it not that my judgment tells me he will play us false.
Forgive me, sir, says Moore quietly. But if he does, we've lost nothing. For if we don't trust him, we're dead anyway, all of us. We know that, and
at least we can die with honour, cries some fool. And the younger chaps cheered like the idiots they were.
At this, Wheeler's head came up, and I saw his stubborn lip go out. And I thought, now, Fleshy, now's your time, or the stupid old bastard will damn us all in the name of duty and honour. So I growled in my throat and scraped my heel, and that caught his attention just in time, and he looked at me.
"'You've said nothing, Fleshman,' says he. "'What is your thought?'
I felt all their eyes turn to me, and deliberately took my time, for I knew Wheeler was within an ace of deciding to fight it out to a finish, and I was going to have to humbug him and the rest of them into surrendering. But it was going to require my most artistic handling.
"'Well, sir,' says I, "'like you, I wouldn't trust the Nana as far as the tuck shop.'
Someone laughed. Homely old Flashy, you see, with his schoolboy metaphors. But as Moore here says, that don't matter. What does, or so it seems to me, is the fate of our ladies. Here I looked red-faced and noble. And the youngsters. If we accept the Nana's offer, at least there's a chance they'll come off safe.
You'd surrender, says Wheeler in a strained voice.
For myself, growls I, and looked at the floor. Well, I never quite got the habit. Goes against the grain, I reckon. Matter of honour, as someone said just now.
And I suppose it can be said that honour demands we fight it out to the last.
Shabash, cries Delafosse. Well done, Flashy.
But, do you know, sir, I went on,
the day my honour has to be maintained by sacrificing Vibart's little boy, or Tunstall's mother, or Mrs. Newnham's daughter. Well, I raised my head and stared at the circle of faces. A strong, simple man stirred to his depths. You could have heard a pin drop. I don't know. I made it wrong. But I don't think my honour's worth that much, do you know? The beauty of it was, while it was the most fearful gammon coming from me, it was stark truth for the rest of them, gallant and honourable souls that they were. The irony was that, for my own cowardly, selfish reasons, I was arguing the sane and sensible course, and having to dress it up in high-sounding bilge in order to break down their fatuous notions of duty. Reason wouldn't have done it, but to suggest that the true honour demanded surrender for the women and children's sake, that shamed them into sanity. Old Ewart put the final touch to it.
"And that, gentlemen, you would do well to bear in mind," he glared almost defiantly at Delafosse, "is the opinion of the man who held Piper's Fort and led the Light Brigade."
Wheeler put it to the formality of a vote, but it was foregone now. When Moore and Whiting voted to surrender, even the fieriest of the young men gave way. And inside half an hour, Wheeler's answer was on its way to Nana, agreeing to capitulate with the honours of war. But he added the condition that we should not only keep our arms, but 60 rounds a man instead of the proposed 20. "Then, if there is treachery, it will profit him little," he told us, and echoed the thought Azimullah had expressed in the afternoon. "We can fight as well in the open as in this death trap." That was all he knew. He was still fearful of treachery, you see. I was not. You may think I was deluding myself, but the fact was, I couldn't see that the Nana had anything to gain by playing us false. I state that honestly now, and I've explained the details of the Cawnpore surrender, because it was a momentous thing not only in the mutiny, but in Indian history. I had spoken, and as I've said, I believe mine was the decisive voice, for surrender, because I saw it as the only way to save my skin. But apart from that vital consideration, I still believe that surrender was right by every canon of soldiering and common sense. Call me a fool, if you like, and shake your heads in the light of history. Nothing could have been worse than fighting on in that doomed entrenchment. Whatever misgivings Wheeler may have had, hardly anyone else shared them when word got round of what had been decided, and Azimullah and Jwala Pershad had come to the entrenchment with the Nana's undertakings all signed and witnessed. Draft animals were to arrive at dawn for the mile-long journey to the river where boats would be waiting, and throughout the night there was bustle and eagerness and thanksgiving all through the garrison. It was as though a great shadow had been lifted. Cooking fires blazed outside the barrack for the first time in weeks. The wounded were brought out of that stinking oven to lie in the open air, and even the children frolicked on the parapet where we'd been slashing at the sepoys 2 days before. Tired, worn faces were smiling. No one minded the dirt and stench any longer, or gave a thought to the rebels' massed guns and infantry a few hundred yards away. The firing had stopped, the fear of death had lifted. We were going out to safety, and throughout the night, over the din of packing and preparation, the sound of hymns rolled up to the night sky. One of the few croakers was Ilderim. Wheeler had told those sepoys who had remained loyal and fought in the garrison to slip away over the southern rampart, for fear of reprisals from their mutinous fellows in the morning, but Ilderim wouldn't have it. He came to me in the dark at the north entrenchment, where I was smoking a cheroot and enjoying my peace of mind. "Do I slip away like a cur when someone throws a stone at it?" says he. "No, I march with Wheeler Saab and the rest of you tomorrow. And so that no pie-dog of a mutineer will take me for anything but what I am, I have put this on for a kilot." And as he stepped closer in the gloom, I saw that he was in the full fig of a native officer of cavalry, white coat, gauntlets, long-tailed puggaree and all. "It is just a down-country regiment's coat which I took from one of those we slew the other day, but it will serve to mark me as a soldier." He grinned, showing his teeth. "And I shall take my 60 rounds. Do thou likewise, blood brother." "We're not going to need them, though," says I, and he shrugged. "Who knows? When the tiger has its paw on the goat's neck and then smiles in friendship, Wheeler Sahib does not trust the Nana. Dost thou?" "There's no choice, is there?" says I. "But he signed his name to a promise after all."
"And if he breaks it, the dead can complain," says he, and spat. "So I say,
keep thy 60 rounds to hand, Flashman Sahib. I didn't heed him much, for Pathans are notoriously suspicious of everyone, reason or none. And when day broke, there was too much to do to waste time in thinking. The mutineers came in at the first mists of dawn, with bullocks and elephants and carts to carry us to the river, and we had the Herculean task of getting everyone into the convoy. There were 200 wounded to be moved, and all the women and children, some of them just babes in arms, and old people who'd have been feeble enough even without 3 weeks on starvation rations. Everyone was tired and filthy and oddly dispirited now that the first flush of excitement had died away. As the sun came up, it shone on a strange nightmare sight that lives with me now only as a series of pictures as the evacuation of Cawnpore began. I can see the straggling mass of the procession, the bullock carts with their stretchers carrying the blood-stained figures of the wounded, gaunt and wasted. Bedraggled white women, either sitting in the carts or standing patiently alongside, with children who looked like Whitechapel waifs clinging to their skirts. Our own men, ragged and haggard, with their muskets cradled, taking up station along the convoy. The red coats and sullen faces of the mutineers who were to shepherd us across the Maidan and down to the river Ghat beyond the distant trees where the boats were waiting. The dawn air was heavy with mist and suspicion and hatred, as Wheeler, with Moor at his elbow as always, stood up on the rampart and reviewed the battered remnants of his command, strung out along the entrenchment, waiting listlessly for the word to move, while all around was the confused babble of voices, orders being shouted, officers hurrying up and down, elephants squealing, the carts creaking, children crying, and the kites beginning to swoop down on the emptying barracks. Incidents and figures remain very clear. 2 civilians hauling down the tattered flag from the barrack roof, rolling it up carefully and bringing it to Wheeler, who stood absent-mindedly with it trailing from one hand, while he shouted, "Sergeant Grady! Is the south entrenchment clear, Sergeant Grady?" A little boy with curly hair, laughing and shouting, "Plop, plop," as one of the elephants dropped its dung. His mother, a harassed young woman in a torn ball gown, it had rosebuds embroidered, I recall, with a sleeping infant in her arms, slapped and shook him with her free hand, and then straightened her hair. A group of mutineers walking round the barracks, belabouring one of our native cooks who was limping along under a great load of pans. A British private, his uniform unrecognizable, being railed at by an old mem sahib, as he helped her into a cart until she was settled, when she said, "Thank you, my good man, thank you very much," and began searching her reticule for a tip. 4 mutineers were hurrying up and down the untidy convoy, calling out and searching until they spotted Vibart and his family, and then they ran hallooing and calling, "Colonel Sahib! Mem Sahib!" and seized on the family's baggage, and one of them, beaming and chuckling, lifted Vibart's little lad onto his shoulders piggyback, while the others shouted and shoved and made room for Mrs. Vibart in a wagon. Vibart was dumbfounded, and 2 of the mutineers were weeping as they took his hand and carried his gear. I saw another one at it too, an old grizzled Havildar of the 56th, standing on the entrenchment, gazing down into the ruin of the barracks, with tears running down his white beard. He was shaking his head in grief, and then he would look no more, but turned about and stared across the Maidan, still crying. Most of the mutineers weren't so sentimental, though. One tried to snatch a musket from Whiting, and Whiting flung him off, snarling and shouting, "You want it, do you? I'll give you its contents fast enough, you damned dog, if you don't take care." The Pandies fell back, growling and shaking their fists, and another gang of them stood and jeered while old Colonel Ewart was carried on a palki to his place in the line. "Is it not a fine parade, Colonel Sahib?" they were jeering. "Is it not well drawn up?" And then they cackled and made mock of the drill, prancing up and down. I didn't like the look of this a bit, or of the menacing-looking crowd of Pandies which was growing across the Maidan. Promises or no promises, it don't take much to touch off a crowd like that, and I was relieved when Moore, who had hurried to the head of the column, shouted and blew his whistle, and the procession began to move, creaking slowly away from the entrenchment and out onto the plain. I was near the rear of the line where Vibart had charge of the supply wagons. Behind us, the Pandies were already scavenging in the deserted barracks. By God, they were welcome to anything they could find.
It was about a mile to the river, where the boats were, but we were so exhausted and the convoy so haphazard and cumbersome that it took us the best part of an hour to cross the Maidan alone. It was a hellish trek, with the mutineers trying to drive us along, swearing and thrusting, and our fellows cursing them back, while wagons foundered and one or two of the garrison collapsed and had to be loaded aboard, and the drivers thrashed at the beasts. Crowds of natives had come down from Cawnpore City to watch and jeer at us and get in the way. Some of them, and the more hostile Pandies, kept sneaking in close to shout taunts, or even to strike at us, and try to steal our belongings. Something's going to crack in a moment, thinks I. And sure enough, just as we were trying to manhandle one of the store wagons over a little white bridge at the far side of the Maidan, where the trees began, there was a crackle of firing off to one side, and sudden shouting, and then more shots. The driver of my store wagon tried to whip up in alarm. A wheel caught on the bridge, and I and two civilians were struggling to keep it steady when Whiting comes up at the run, cocking his musket and demanding to know what the row was. In the same moment, one of our corporals came flying out of the wood, rolled clean under the wagon in front of us, and jumps up, yelling, "Quick, sir, come quick! Them devils is murdering Colonel Hewitt! They got him in the trees yonder, and—" Whiting sprang forward with an oath. But quick as light, one of the mutineers who'd been watching us at the bridge jumps in his way and flung his arm round him. For a moment I thought, oh, God, now they're going to ambush us. And the corporal must have thought the same, for he whipped out his bayonet. But the mutineer holding Whiting was just trying to keep him back and shouting, "Nain, Sahib! Kabada! If you go there, they will kill you! Let be, Sahib! Go on to the river!" Whiting swore and struggled with him, but the mutineer, a big black-moustached Havildar with a Chilean Walla medal, threw him down and wrested his musket away. Whiting came up, furious, but the corporal understood and grabbed his wrist. "He's right, sir. Them swine'll just soft carrow you like they've done the colonel. We got to get onto the river, like he says. Otherwise, maybe they'll do for everybody. The women and kids and all, sir." He was right, of course. I'd been through the same sort of retreat as this back in Afghanistan, and you've got to allow for a few stray slaughters and turn a blind eye, or the next thing you know, you'll have a battle on your hands. Even Whiting realized it, I think, for he wheeled on the Havildar and says, "I must see. Will you come with me?" The fellow says, "Han, Sahib." And they strode into the trees. It seemed a sensible time to be getting on down to the river, so I told the corporal I must inform Wheeler of what was happening, ordered him to see the store wagon safely over the bridge, and jumped up onto the coping, running past the carts ahead, with their passengers demanding to know what was happening. I hurried on through the trees, and found myself looking down the slope to the Sati Chora Ghat, and beyond it the broad, placid expanse of the Ganges. End of side 14.